Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
We don't think about these things all the time, but actually what you're doing in the kitchen is a form of science. And in a lot of the experiments I did when I was in research, we would use similar things like a blender, a warring blender, or a mortar and pestle to crush cells, use glass beads, you know, all those kind of things. And it was fascinating that we were doing the same thing in the kitchen.
Today, we're talking to the supremely gifted Nick Sharma, the author of Season, Big Flavors, Beautiful Food, and the creator of the amazing blog, A Brown Table. He also writes a column for the San Francisco Chronicle called A Brown Kitchen. So when you started putting brown in your titles, whether it's the brown table or a brown kitchen, was that in part like your way of saying, this is who I am and I'm proud of it and, you know, just live with it, everybody?
There were two reasons behind it. One was the fact that at the time, brown wood was a popular prop in photography.
Huh.
And I couldn't come up with the name. I'm really not good at coming up with leads and book titles and obviously blog names too. And so that's where that was the idea behind that. And the other thing I said, well, it's also playful because I'm brown and I think it works.
Got it. So you're doing the newspaper column, and how did the book come about?
At the time what happened, I had won my second IACP award for my blog. And when that happened, an agent reached out to me to write a cookbook. And I wasn't sure because a couple of years ago, I had reached out to agents who had kind of turned me down and said I didn't have anything to write about.
And, nice. That's such a great reaction. That really makes you want to just keep on going, doesn't it?
It does. It actually does. You know why? Because if you come from the science world, your professors will tell you that you have really nothing to tell them.
That's awesome. So your science background really came in handy when the rejection started coming in.
Right. I think one of the things with rejection is you have to learn how to take it with a grain of salt and learn to figure out what your point of view is, whether you're in science, whether your theory is right or wrong, and whether you have the tools to get there. And so it made me reevaluate my thoughts on whether, I should really write a cookbook, whether really the agent was right and did I really have something new to tell people, and why was my book going to be different from everybody else's, you know, because as you know, there are so many cookbooks that come out each year.
Absolutely.
And I think one of the misconceptions that I had early on was that a cookbook would be the next stage in my career, but something that I had to do. Which isn't true. I don't, you know, there was a point when I told myself, I don't think I need to do a cookbook also. So when the agent reached out to me, I wasn't really sure. We spoke quite a bit. We even met up in person till she said, no, I actually do believe that you have something to tell people that's different. And we both worked on a proposal together. And this was at the same time that I was working at the food startup in San Francisco and just started writing my food column for the Chronicle. And you know, we sold a proposal and then I started to work on Season.
Yeah. And that's interesting. And since you were doing both the column and the book at the same time, did you have to come to an agreement with the Chronicle or did you just say, okay, I'm not going to use anything from the Chronicle in the book? I know that's always a thing when it comes to Serious Eats is books or Kenji's book or mm-hmm. Stella's book or whatever.
Yeah, I didn't have to worry about that. In fact, I didn't even think about it.
Good.
Because the main thing what I wanted to do was with the book, I feel if people are going to spend money on something, they need new content. And that's my personal opinion, because they could get that stuff for free elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I did, I decided because my fans wanted me to include the most popular recipe from my blog. I thought that would be okay. And so I picked the apple cake that's in my book, the masala cha apple cake, which at the time was one of the most popular recipes on the blog. So I put that in the book. But then everything else, I really wanted to be different to kind of reflect how everything that I had done in my life had also influenced this book.
So there was a larger point you were trying to make with the book.
Right. I kind of wanted people to first not think it was an Indian cookbook. And I wanted to look at it from the way that this is how an immigrant cooks. And also this is what it means to cook with flavor to me.
So you start the book with a flavor glossary, speaking of flavor. Mm-hmm. What exactly is that, and why include it in your book?
Yeah, so that was an idea that came up by my editor. And I thought it was brilliant because one of the things, even for me, who is someone who grew up in India with spices, being around them all day, I find it sometimes hard to distinguish between something like cumin or caraway because they all look similar, right? And the shape of the seed is so similar. So if they're not placed next to each other, it's really difficult. And so I decided to put myself in my readers' shoes from, you know, based on the blog and then the column. And based on their comments over the years, I started also polling them with questions to find out what do they find uncomfortable. And one of the things is with Indian cooking is with spices. And I think this is common with any other culture that's not mainstream, is people are scared of spices as they're scared of people. It's, I always put it in terms of xenophobia. Like you're always scared of what you don't know.
Sure.
Right. And so the same thing with spices. So I said, this is a great way to kind of, since attention spans have also changed over the past couple of years, something visual will probably resonate much better with people. So if they go to the store and they know what it looks like, then
they won't be as scared.
Right. You feel more confident in asking for something.
Before we leave the apple cake behind, the masala apple cake, I do love an apple cake. My grandmother, may she rest in peace, made a phenomenal apple cake.
Oh.
How did you make it yours?
I go with what excites me in the moment, to be honest. So, like with this apple cake, if we take this as an example, apple cakes and spice cakes were something that I learned about when I came to America, that during when the weather starts to cool off, people naturally in America deviate to warmer spices in their desserts. And, you know, we've got the spice cakes that kind of do that. Even mulled wine does that. And so I said, how do I put these flavors in, but kind of connect the apple cake that's so American to me with something that's Indian in my experience, but also brings that level of warmth. And the masala chai spice, or the chai masala rather, works really well here because it's got those combination of warm flavors. And then I said, if I'm going to call it a masala chai cake, and chai meaning tea, I need to put tea leaves in it, or tea in some form. I need to incorporate that. So I put that into the batter and made a flour with that. And to me, that represents kind of this, I wouldn't say fusion, but this kind of meeting of ideas in between.
Yeah, I love that. I love that because it's sort of emblematic of the way you cook and the way you think.
Right.
So I want to talk a little bit about your photographic point of view. On page 75 in the book, you have these lentils that look like rocks.
Uh-huh.
And you really do have an original photographic voice. How would you describe it, and how did it evolve?
Well, evolve is through trial and error, because I at least had no idea what even composition was. And one of the things, even though my dad, the two pieces of advice I got from my dad on photography was what kind of camera to buy. He's used Nikon for all his life. And so it made sense for me to use Nikon because that's a brand that he's worked with. But to be honest, now as I'm more mature, I think no brand is really superior to the other. It's your lenses that matter. But in terms of point of view, I think that was a lot through trial and error, because for the longest time, I was trying to do what everyone else was doing. And it felt okay, but it didn't make me happy. And then I was also letting, again, people define who I was even artistically.
Yes, there's a theme, sort of, there's a through line here, Nick, I'm getting. You know, it's like each time, and this is true of, I think, of most creative people, we tend to emulate or imitate the people we respect and admire.
Right.
But at a certain point, you go, this is them, it's not me.
Right. And it came to me early on that it just didn't feel right. Why was I trying to be like everyone else? And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And so I started to evolve as a writer, as well as a photographer and a cook, and started exploring how I could push my limits.
And so at that point, it's trial and error, and there's nobody that you're going, God, I'm inspired by whoever, Ouija, it doesn't matter, Walker Evans, or any photographer.
Right. I wanted to see what excites me and why was I liking food so much? And so I wanted to convey that through my photos. And so I needed to understand myself in order to put myself out there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. You title something in the book, says, which I think harkens obviously back to your science background, your kitchen is your lab. What did you mean by that?
So one of the things that in the kitchen I've realized is that a lot of us, even when we're handed down a recipe from a family member, be it a grandmother or a mother, we end up changing it quite a bit over time to make it our own. And that is experimentation in its own way. And so in my case, I already had that training to do that because one of the things I really like about recipes, the way they're written, is exactly the way I would prepare my buffers in biochemistry or in genetics, you know, for my enzymes. We call them recipes. We pretty much use the same terminology. Everything's arranged by volume or when it has to go in. And so these were the things that I found there were a lot of similarities. And so when I write recipes, I actually still use lab notebooks and I write things down in iterations, like, you know, version one, version two, version three. And so I try to do that with the recipes and work through them in an experimental way where it may not work the first time, but how do I make it better? So let me look at it analytically.
And like Kenji, you sort of take your readers on your adventure.
I do.
And that seems to be important to you.
That is, because I want people to understand that when you walk into the kitchen, you don't have to be compelled to succeed the first time. I think that's something very cultural where there is this impetus to push people for success. But I think we forget sometimes that it's okay to fail because it's your failures that you'll remember. You'll never remember what you succeeded at or why, but it's when you fail, you start to remember what was wrong. How can you fix it? And it makes you much wiser.
You know, Bob Dylan wrote, "There's no success like failure, and failure is no success at all." We got to think about that when it comes to cooking.
Yeah.
Let's talk now. I want to get back to seasoning because it's a big part of your book. And you talk about the hows of seasoning.
Yeah.
And you say grinding, bruising and chopping, toasting, infusing, muddling, smoking, brining, marinating and applying rubs, browning, and then bringing it all together. So what were you trying to communicate in terms of the hows of seasoning?
I didn't want this particular book to be something too scientific because it was an introductory book. And I kind of wanted to introduce myself to people. At the same time, I wanted to be really approachable. So someone who is intimidated by it being too sciencey kind of understands that the simplest things that they're doing in the kitchen actually have a scientific basis for them. So something that you might not think about, like you mentioned bruising, is a way to pull out the essential oils, for example, in mint, into a drink. You know, you're breaking those cells to release those essential oils, so then they get solubilized in whatever solvent they're in, so like water. And we don't think about these things all the time, but actually what you're doing in the kitchen is a form of science. And in a lot of the experiments I did when I was in research, we would use similar things like a blender, a warring blender, or a mortar and pestle to crush cells, use glass beads, you know, all those kind of things. And it was fascinating that we were doing the same thing in the kitchen in a very different way.
You got to level with me, Nick. At any time when you were in that lab, were you making pesto in the blender?
I did. Okay. I can say now since I'm no longer employed by anyone. Well, at least from science, but I did at one point, I was really concerned about yogurt. Why was my yogurt when I made it at home not the same kind of yogurt back in India? And so I actually ended up taking cultures and gram staining them and looking under the microscope to see what was wrong.
But not telling your professor that you were doing that.
No, I didn't need to. And I think even if they saw it, they wouldn't really care because they all did their own. I actually had a professor who would, if I'm correct, he actually ran wine samples once and an osmometer to measure osmolality.
I don't even know what that is, but it sounds complicated.
But yeah, I mean, so I did like a lot of the stuff, I sneaked it in. But at the same time, I also, one of the things I, you know, I was lucky to do was learn about biology. And in so biology, you end up doing a lot of stuff which is edible. So a lot of the experiments I did was learning how to isolate pectin or gelatin from plant or animal tissues, you know, measure the yield of casein in different kinds of milk. And so that, I think, kind of, it, for me, it just made sense. Oh, yeah, you would have to do this in a lab anyway.
Got it. So You write about the pantry. I firmly believe that a person's wealth lies in his or her kitchen pantry.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of radical.
Not really so. And that's the reason why I put it in, because if you go to anybody's refrigerator, it might not be stocked with actual ingredients, right? You might not have vegetables or fruit or meat or whatever in there. You will see a lot of condiments. Go to the pantry and it's the same thing. You might not see actual, you obviously won't see actual meals in there, but you will see a bunch of random spices or, you know, like a marshmallow or two or something sitting in there, like a half a bag of lentils. And I think that's what reflects the wealth of a person, because it's kind of like visiting someone's house and you look at the number of books they have or the stack of magazines and you get an idea of how they think.
Right. So is the
pantry. It's the same thing.
The pantry is, you think the pantry is kind of a Rorschach test.
Yeah. Like you walk in and you say, wow, this is something interesting. I don't have that at home. Maybe I should get it. Why do they have it? Let me ask them that question. And what do they do with it? And so, and in often what happens in many cases, and this is something that I've seen with home cooks a lot, is we're always trying to make do with what we have already at home.
It's true.
Right? And so if I have, say, a bit of ground beef, I don't really want to go out and buy something new. Sometimes I want to work with what I have at home. So how do I make that happen? And so that was what I was trying to tell people, is that your pantry is probably well-stocked already. Let's see what we can do with it.
Yep. Who's had the greatest influence on you, sort of cooking-wise, writing-wise, and photography-wise? And they probably are different people.
Yeah. I'll start with photography. So photography, one of the places that I don't have any particular names, but one of the places that I actually look for inspiration is anything that's not food-related.
It's great. And you actually talk about, I saw a video online where you talk about photography in terms of dance and curves.
Yeah.
That was really fascinating. So you're going to have to really you have some splaining to do, man.
Okay. So one of the things I'm drawn to are curves. I find curves to be really sensual. And actually did a poll recently with people as to what kind of taste they associate shapes of food with taste. And curves seem to be very popular with people. And I think it's because curves are so sensual. Your eye tends to move on a smooth line and it's drawn, whereas quadrilaterals and, you know, lines tend to be a little sharper. And so they feel a little harsh. And so it's soothing. And one of the things I think about when I'm styling food is that I always think of, I liked food because I think the process is beautiful by the way it happens. The final dish is beautiful. The ingredients are beautiful. And I'm not referring to the way things are styled, but just the idea and concept.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to convey that in a way that made sense to me. And for me, that was, oh, look at this ballerina on stage. When she's dancing, everything falls. It becomes noise. Everything around her is noise and it gets pushed away to the darkness. And then you have the light just focusing on her. So when I photograph in style, I kind of keep that always in mind, where I want to photograph this process as being the ballerina right now.
Yeah.
That's what makes it beautiful in that moment to me. Because sometimes I think we take the most, I guess, the simplest tasks in food for granted. Like even rubbing a lemon on a cutting board just to loosen the cells up. That's such a beautiful process that we don't think about. There's so much going on in there. The cells are breaking, the essential oils are coming out, and you're getting to smell that aroma.
Yeah.
And so, and I think those are like the littlest things that make it so beautiful.
Yeah, I think you're right. So what about your cooking or your writing?
In terms of cooking and writing, I think I'm heavily influenced by home cook authors, especially Diana Henry's one.
Mm-hmm. She's a famous, for people who don't know, British cookbook author.
Yeah. I love the way that she approaches food in a very mature, sophisticated way, but it's also very casual and welcoming. Nigella Lawson is another author that I really love. And I also really like Nigel Slater, because they do the same thing. They make it approachable for home cooks. At the same time, they're also teasing them with new ideas.
Do you have a British fixation? What's up with that? All three of those people. Don't tell me you're into the royal wedding and the royal babies.
I'm definitely not into that.
Okay.
But I do appreciate, for some reason, I do appreciate a lot of British authors. From the American side, I do like Mifke Fisher. I think her writing is very it's again very sophisticated and mature, which I'm not. So I really enjoy people who do that. And then authors that are from India, like Julie Sani is one of you know, I really like the books that she wrote, Madhur Jaffrey. And then I feel like Honey & Co, that's not really well known. They're from the Middle East. They are again based in London, but they've written several books. They're not really well known here yet, but I feel their work is also so compelling because they come from the restaurant side of the world, but they make it approachable for home cooks.
What are their names?
Itmar and Sarit.
I need three recipes people should start with from the book and why. I know me personally, I'm going to make the sweet potato babinka for Thanksgiving because that seemed and looked so awesome.
Yeah, and for the people that hate making pies, I think that's an easy way to do it.
Yeah.
Definitely, since we're heading in towards the Stoneford season, I would recommend trying the broiled peaches with the maple vinegar syrup. That's one of my favorite desserts in the book because it's simple and easy. And then I would recommend the cauliflower paneer salad because that's a different way of looking at paneer. Classically, it's, you know, I always see people substituting feta for paneer or cottage cheese or something else. I think it's time to celebrate paneer for what it is. And so I try to do that with the salad and showcase that it can, it holds its structure like a lot of the other Greek cheeses. And so it works well. It's easy to make at home if you can't find it. All you need is milk and some kind of food acid. And then the third recipe I would recommend is to go ahead and make the meatloaf.
The meatloaf?
Yeah, because the meatloaf is something that is so iconically American to me.
This is Cincinnati meets India meets San Francisco meets Washington, D.C.
Meets the South. Yeah, because, you know, my husband really loves meatloaf. It was one of the things that he made me when we started dating. And we make it, we don't make it that often now. But the meatloaf was something that I said, I need to do kind of something like an East meets West kind of thing in this dish. And it's such a classic, iconic American dish. How do I make it much more flavorful? I'm not a big fan of ketchup on meatloaf, so I made my own sauce for this. So it's sweet, it's spicy, but it's also really moist because of the apples that go into it.
Oh, I am gonna try this. You know, the Frank Bruni did a whole book of people's meatloaf recipes.
Oh wow, I need to look for that.
So what's next, Nick? You've climbed a lot of mountains in a relatively short period of time. Besides writing for Serious Eats, I think that's what's next.
We'll see. We'll see what happens. But I am working on a new cookbook that is definitely going to be more science focused this time for home cooks. And it'll be out in fall 2020.
Great. That's awesome. So now it's time for the All You Can Answer special sauce buffet. No pressure. You can take your time.
Okay.
So who's at your last supper, no family allowed?
I wouldn't invite family anyway. They'll be too critical.
Okay. I like that.
Let's see. I think I'd like to have Kenji and Stella.
You say that to all the guys.
No, I love Stella because Stella's been so wonderful and I can always, I mean, Stella's like someone you can knock on a door and she'll have an answer for you.
That's so true.
I love Stella.
We should say that Stella Parks is Serious Eats. I call her our pastry wizard and Kenji Lopez-Alt is, as everyone I think knows at this point, wrote an amazing book called The Food Lab and was our culinary director and is still our culinary advisor at Serious Eats. So I like that. There's one more person though, besides Stella and Kenji, that I need to have to finish out the table.
Okay, Samin Nosrat.
Samin Nosrat.
Yeah.
Is that someone you've gotten to know out there or just someone you admire?
Both. So Samin and I, we both live, well, she lives in Berkeley, I live in Oakland, so we kind, and we obviously know each other since we run in the same circles. But Samin is someone that I really admire because she's someone that's also a child of immigrants and has been so successful. I'm really in awe of what she's been able to accomplish, but she's also just a really nice person and knows her flavor well. And the three people that I selected for this dinner really know their flavor well. So if they had to, give me criticism, it would be objective.
I like that. So what are you eating?
Right now?
No, at the Last Supper.
At the Last Supper. So there will be ice cream for sure.
Okay.
Because I'm a big ice cream fan, so there will be ice cream.
All right.
Let's see. I will probably make some kind of rice dish.
Okay.
That will have saffron for sure and a bunch of spices. So maybe some kind of pilaf, mm-hmm. as you'd like to, as people call it. I'll probably do a whole roast chicken, because that's a great trick for a home cook to look impressive. You make a big chicken, everyone's impressed, and it takes minimal work.
That's great. And you have this line in the book about flavoring a whole chicken, that the trick is to keep the sauce between the skin and the flesh, because the layer of fat in the skin helps the chicken retain its moisture while the flavors in the marinade penetrate the flesh.
Yeah, I don't know why people do it the other way. Like, I get the salt outside, but I want the flavor to touch the meat.
Yeah.
That's just me, but... And then, oh, yeah, we got to have a salad. So probably do, depending on what's in season, I'll make a salad for them. And then, let's see, we have to have a vegetable dish. So maybe a roasted cauliflower or something.
That sounds great, man. Can I come?
Yeah.
All right. What do you cook when there's nothing in the house to eat?
If I have eggs at home, which I usually do, then I'll probably work with the eggs and call it a day.
Mm-hmm.
But often what I'll do is I will just make a quick soup.
Assuming that there's stock, either store-bought or that you've made.
Yeah, sometimes I don't even use stock.
You use water?
Yeah. And then I just flavor it as I go.
Got it.
I usually have a well-stocked pantry. I might not have a lot of things in the fridge, but you can work your way through with the pantry and make it work.
So do you have a guilty pleasure?
Ice cream. Although I don't feel guilty about it.
Neither do I. Like, straight up, like, are we talking Humphrey Slocum? You're from San Francisco, Byright Creamery. Like, which one of those ice creams, like, really touches you?
So I'll get in trouble for saying this, because I'm not going to pick something local. I'm going to pick Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams.
She's Columbus, right?
Yeah.
I think she's in Cincinnati now, but she started in Columbus.
But the thing with Jenny's ice cream is that she is the only one that makes a really beautiful tart lemon ice cream.
Got it.
And no one has ever been able to compare to that. And that's the only thing I get from Jenny's, is that lemon ice cream, or I make it from her book at home.
That's so great. So what's on your nightstand right now, book-wise? Doesn't have to be food-related.
Oh my God, it is food-related.
That's okay. That's good.
I'm currently reading... Arabesque by Claudia Rodin.
She's an amazing scholarly writer.
Yeah, I love everything that all the work that she's done. I don't have any of her other books. I only have Arabesque and Middle Eastern Feasts.
I think
that's the book. And both of them taught me a lot personally about cooking Middle Eastern food.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually been reading the book just for her essays. They're also fun, the way she approaches stuff.
That's cool. What's the most influential book you've ever read? Like, that influences you personally, on your career, on your life?
There's a book called Genome by Matt Ridley.
Mm-hmm.
That was a book that I read early before I was, I think, in grad school. And it talks about each chromosome as a chapter, each human chromosome. And I think they've done updates to it. But it makes you appreciate how our bodies affect our different ways of life, from food to, you know, sociology and everything.
Right.
So that has always played in my mind when I've gone through life, even like now with the writing about food. You know, one of the things that a common theme that comes up about, like, taste, you know, we're attached to like bitter taste or not to taste. And so those are the things that he talks about. And I've always been kind of paid attention to that.
So who's had the greatest influence on you in your career?
Dana Henry.
Have you ever met her?
Yeah, we're really close friends.
That's great.
I love her.
And why has she been the greatest influence? Because you just admire the way she thinks and she cooks?
What I really appreciate about Dana is her ability to introduce new ideas and make them comfortable for home cooks. At the same time, she's also a prolific cookbook author.
Yeah.
And she's also been hugely supportive of my career. I can always ask her about books that I've never heard about, or mm-hmm. a topic that, and you need that in the food world. You need someone. The same case with John Bertzall. He's been also really influential in my life in directing me in the right direction. And both of these authors have really taken their time to help someone who was relatively unknown at a certain point and invest in them because they believed in their voice and work. And that doesn't happen a lot. So to me, that, you know, both of them, both John and Dan, are really special to me.
It's just been declared Nick Sharma Day all over the world. Okay. What's happening on that day?
Everybody gets a tub of really good lemon ice cream.
Okay. There's a theme there.
It should be warm because I hate days when they're cold.
Okay.
And I think everybody should write a line on a piece of paper to say what they did that made them really proud of themselves that day.
I love this. I love Nick Sharma Day. We're going to make it happen. Let's say September or October. We're going to make it happen.
Okay. Okay.
So thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Nick Sharma. Pick up a copy of Season, Big Flavors, Beautiful Food. Read Nick's terrific blog, A Brown Table, as well as his column, A Brown Kitchen, in the San Francisco Chronicle, and his about-to-be column in Sirius East. No. But anyway, thank you, Nick. It's been awesome.
Thanks for having me on, Ed.
So long, Sirius Eaters. We'll see you next time.